African Climate Change Conversation podcast. My name is Andrew Murray-Watson, and I'm part of the communications team at British International Investment, the UK's development finance institution and impact investor. Today, I have the great pleasure of having a conversation with James Irungu Mwangi. James is the founder of the Climate Action Platform for Africa, which he launched in 2021 to help unlock Africa's potential to transform its economies while playing a leading role in effective climate action. Prior to that, he spent 20 years at the Dalberg Group, which he helped found, leading the firm's expansion into Africa in 2007, serving as global managing partner of Dalberg Advisors, and most recently as executive director of the Dalberg Group. During his tenure, James led the growth, incubation, or acquisition of many of the entities that today constitute Dalberg's operational footprint in over 25 countries on six continents. James also serves as an independent director on several boards, including the Skoll Foundation, the Global Centre for Pluralism, One Acre Fund, Old Mutual Limited, and Cocoa Networks. He is a 2009 Archbishop Tutu Leadership Fellow of the African Leadership Institute, a 2013 Young Global Leader of the World Economic Forum, and a 2021 Yale World Fellow. He holds an honorary degree in economics from Harvard University. James is also a passionate advocate for renewable energy-backed industrialization of the African continent, and someone who believes gas should have no part in the energy mix going forward. James, thank you so much for your time today. I wanted to start by asking you about COP27, and specifically the expectation that there will be a renewed call for Africa to be allowed to exploit its gas reserves. Perhaps you could explain your position on gas.
Yeah, I think, thanks for the question, Andrew. I think when we think of Africa and its endowment of natural resources, including fossil fuels, I think one point that I completely agree with, and hopefully any fair-minded listener or observer would agree with, is Africa has done the least to contribute to the climate crisis we're in, and as a result has derived the smallest benefit from the fossil fuel dividend while facing some of the highest costs of carbon emissions. And so Africa is at once in a position where we need to take seriously the need to decarbonize because climate change is going to hit us first and hardest. But at the same time, we need to make the most of our resources in order to advance the majority of Africa's people out of poverty. Now, when it comes to gas in particular, I think that the first thing to be clear on is what do we mean by exploiting our gas reserves? Right. If by that people mean that Africa should be allowed to explore, produce and export its gas and other fossil fuels to the world in return for money to fuel its development, that is non-controversial. And if we're honest, that is the 99% of the actual investment, or maybe 95% historically of the investment in Africa's fossil fuel infrastructure has been, like investment in every other natural resource of Africa, focused on extracting it and shipping it out. So I think when we talk about Africa's endowment of fossil fuels and how we make use of it, I think we need to set aside dogma and take a hard-nosed, long-term view. The reality is the vast majority of investment into oil and gas in Africa is geared towards and continues to be geared towards export, basically developing oil and gas fields and packaging those fossil fuels for export. Very rarely, there's an increasing effort to look at whether we can use more of that on the continent. But in some ways, some of the argument tends to be disingenuous and frankly creates a false tension, because if someone in the world is going to buy, natural gas and need to be supplied by somebody, yeah, it should probably be supplied by Africa, because Africa has had the least kind of opportunity to monetize some of those resources of any part. So in an environment where we're trying to reduce the global fossil fuel market in total, Africa's share of that market should definitely grow. I don't disagree with that at all. That's not the debate I'm interested in having, to be perfectly honest. I think there's a different debate about, and there's a second debate. If you already have fossil fuel burning infrastructure that has not run out its useful life and is still able to produce at an economically competitive level, should you be able to use it? So I'm not talking about inefficient old coal plants here. If you happen to have an efficient new gas power plant or fertilizer factory in Africa, should you be allowed to use it? And I would say you have more right to it than almost anyone anywhere in the world. I think where I do part company with some folks is, should we, from a blank sheet of paper, assume that the smartest way to use our existing fossil fuel endowment is to build new power plants and new fertilizer factories and so on that use these fossil fuels, regardless of the fact that we know that the prohibition against carbon emissions is going to only grow over the next few decades. And there, I think we just have to run cold, hard numbers and not fall victim to wishful thinking, which I see very often where people say, yes, we should be allowed to use natural gas to power economies, but without any thought to how long will it take for that first natural gas powered plant to be deployed? How will it be economically competitive to other alternatives at that point in time? And how long will it need to operate in order to pay itself off? Because if you get any of those numbers wrong, you are not striking a blow for Africa's energy freedom. You are creating the next set of stranded assets that destroy Africa's limited pool of savings when they're inevitably mothballed, not because of any sort of climate compliance, but because of the very simple fact that in a world of increasingly zero marginal cost energy, you know, later this century, any energy with some marginal cost from the purchase of inputs is going to struggle to be competitive. Now, again, there will be countries where the needs of maintaining a base load and so on mean that actually gas makes sense as the most climate smart of the available options for providing that non-variable, non-intermittent source that anchors your grid. But countries should be very careful to figure out whether they are one of those cases, because if they are not, then the penalty isn't that they will have to deal with the funny looks from the rest of the world because they're emitting and others are not. It is that they will likely find that those assets are non-economically viable sooner than would allow them to earn a return on those assets. And that's a pure financial consideration.
Thank you. Can renewables be developed quickly enough to meet Africa's development requirements? I mean, in particular, do they provide a solution for industrial applications where there is an intense energy demand?
I think that at a minimum, we need to run that math honestly and transparently rather than take it as dogma. I think there will be different answers for different countries. If I'm sitting in an East African country with access to the Rift Valley and it's a large untapped geothermal baseload potential, as well as high quality solar and some competitive terrestrial wind, as well as some hydro, I have a pretty long way to go before I'm at the point where I'm saying I need to be looking at other sources to top up my energy needs. In other words, the gap, you know, Kenya right now has a 3-gigawatt grid. Geothermal alone has 10 gigawatts of proven potential capacity in the country, of which we are only tapping 1 gigawatt today. So again, there's a question mark there. Solar, for example, and again, you know, there's an aspect here of also keeping in mind where we are. There's a good reason why the intermittency of solar is really problematic in the Northern Hemisphere, because you're not just dealing with day and night, you're dealing with entire seasons where you have really, really big dips. But solar plus storage actually makes sense in a lot of countries in Africa. And importantly, when we're talking about speed, solar plus storage is one of the fastest energy solutions to roll out. If you agree the terms of a gas plant today, right, and have to develop the infrastructure to run it, you're talking about several years before you can achieve a single megawatt of power from it. A solar plant can be done in a year and can continue to expand in a modular fashion. Not to mention the fact that distributed solar generation, you know, coming onto the grid at different points in the country can allow you to start getting a more balanced form of generation in countries that are close to the tropics and thus have fairly stable solar. Now, granted, some places will have cloud cover and rains and so on and so forth. So it's not dogmatic, but it's rather to say, if we're having the conversation about how quickly things can be brought on board and how much they will cost, let's have that conversation and let's actually have the conversation in the spreadsheets and not in dogmatic slogans. Because I think we will find that where the prices are going and where the timelines are going increasingly says the cold, hard mathematical logic points away from fossil fuels, except in very special instances.
Do you think dogma and ideology is creeping back into this debate over the last few years in a way it hadn't been before?
I think so. I think that, and on all sides, I think that, and it's not unique to the energy debate, it's just a reality that across a range of policy questions, we are in a much more polarized space as a planet today than we were before. And there's a lot less engagement with just the details of, well, do we all agree that this is how much, for example, power we need to generate for this long in this way for these use cases? And much more of, well, it's my right to do this, or, you know, you shouldn't do that because it's a bad thing for the planet. I think, though, that for Africa in particular, we need to take advantage of the fact that we don't have as big a stake in the current global energy system as any other region of the world. And usually, you know, when I think back to, you know, business case studies and so on, when you have a new technology that attacks an industry, usually it's not the big incumbents that are able to really ride that because they've got too much vested in the previous format. In a sense, if the world is shifting to a low carbon model of production and consumption over the next 30 to 40 years, which science says we have to, then in a way there lies Africa's secret advantage. We don't have as big a vested stake. We're a new entrant and we should behave like a new entrant and ask the question, not what are the people who are vested in the old system doing and how do we copy them, but rather what can't they do because of the fact that they're vested in the old system that we can do better, and how do we seize advantage from that angle?
So you see Africa as kind of the disruptor, the innovator.
We have the potential to be. I fear that a good chunk of our mind space is focused on relitigating past injustices versus pursuing new advantages. And I do not dispute the past injustices by any means, but I think that if you want to be a disruptor, you need to be thinking like a disruptor, which is saying, what do I have in abundance that others lack? A dirty little secret is per capita, Africa is not particularly well endowed with fossil fuels. If you divide our fossil fuel endowment by our population, it's actually fairly modest compared to other regions of the world. Where we are richly endowed, in particular because we have the largest amount of equatorial real estate or tropical real estate of any continent, is we are richly endowed with renewable energy potential. So that's where we are by far our lead. We're also very well endowed in some of the key transition minerals. And so instead of crying about a world gone by in which we were laggards, to say the least, in the best expression of the word, why don't we embrace this brave new world and ask how do we dominate some of the emerging new opportunities, whether it's in renewables or in the production of the transition materials that will be needed to facilitate that pivot to a low carbon future. And I don't see us fully embracing that yet. I think we still look at climate smart innovation as something we do because we kind of maybe should for the good of the future, not something we should grab onto because it's a chance to really leapfrog in the true sense of the word. We use the word leapfrog for things like the mobile revolution in Africa, but we leapfrogged the technology. We leapfrogged over fixed line, but we didn't leapfrog the rest of the planet, right? Africa still has the lowest mobile phone penetration of any continent. So here is a chance to genuinely leapfrog and actually do things better than the rest of the world. And I'm worried that we will squander it if we're too busy also holding on to models that never worked for us in the first place.
I mean, African leaders, I think, will be trusted to make pragmatic choices when it comes to COP27. You know, you're painting a picture where actually renewables more often than not are the pragmatic choice, but that message doesn't seem to be getting through to those delegates going to COP.
And I think that's a function of the fact that it doesn't have, it's a new sector, so it doesn't yet have its full-throated advocates. It doesn't have its incumbent industries. There is a fossil fuel lobby. It's the strongest lobby on planet Earth. And they're very good at articulating the case for their particular products and services. And I think it's worthwhile to take on that case and look at it, but it needs to be compared to something. And I think what's been lacking is a well-articulated, not a general, hey, look at renewables, but here is the math on this particular package of renewables for your country. And you're not doing it to, like I said, you know, earn a nice round of applause at COP, you're doing it for measurable, real effects. One of the ones that I think hopefully should be clearer to every African leader is the energy security one. Because the reality is whether or not you produce your oil and gas domestically is actually irrelevant to the actual price of oil and gas in your country. It's a globally traded liquid commodity. And that means one way or another, if there's a supply shock anywhere in the world, it's going to funnel through into inflation in your country, one way or the other, right? And that's just the way these markets work. The fact that country A produces a lot of something, yes, they will get a big windfall in terms of their export revenues, but then you need to be very thoughtful about how you're sheltering your consumers if you're dependent on that same product in various ways. My worry is that, you know, if we are dependent on these inflation transmitting globally traded fuels as the backbone of our new energy systems, then we will be importing, as we are doing now, a whole range of global shocks into our economies at a time when we actually do need predictability and plain sailing. right? The only driver of the cost of energy from a renewable energy resource is the cost of the plant and the cost of maintenance. After that, it runs. The inputs are free. And in a sense, thinking about that and then saying, if I have a unit of gas in hand, am I better off investing in infrastructure to use it myself? Or am I better off investing in infrastructure to supply to the world at as big a profit as I can secure and investing in infrastructure that will last a lot longer than the next 30 years for my own country's backbone? And I think more often than not, that's going to end up being the answer for African countries. Not all the time, but more often than not.
You've done a lot of research around the economic benefits of a green revolution in Africa, particularly around jobs and I guess monetizing natural capital. Can you just provide a bit more detail on that?
Yeah, I think once you broaden the lens around where we are going, right, and look beyond the next 4 or 5 years, a lot of my thinking is premised on the fact that for almost any individual on planet Earth today, and I don't care which day it is that you're hearing this conversation, today is the day in your life that you will care the least about climate change for the rest of your life. Right? This is a one-way staircase. Every day, the signs get more worrying, the science gets clearer, the damage and the costs get bigger. And that means that activities that either limit our emissions or actually even remove or manage the world's carbon emissions debt will become increasingly valuable. They're somewhat valuable today, but they will become increasingly valuable in the future. And so one of the questions I've been asking is, well, how does one become competitive in the work of averting climate disaster? So the work of carbon removal through nature-based carbon sinks and managing our forests and our farms better. The work of carbon removal, frankly, through engineered means as well, or through other means such as, you know, enhanced weathering and other interventions that folks are looking at. And then asking, are there countries that should be looking at those areas as sources of just internal competitiveness? Africa has a lot of labor. We have the fastest growing workforce in the world. A lot of land that has low marginal utility today that could be used for a range of carbon management activities. And if we focus on making sure that that carbon management and carbon capture, carbon sequestration is well rewarded in global markets, so insisting on good prices and fair treatment of carbon management activity around the world, then that has a potential to unlock, I wouldn't say a gold mine, a carbon mine on the continent, because we are best positioned to do that activity at scale, particularly when you consider Africa in the context of other parts of the world. Now, that's one part of a much broader set of exercises, which involve also asking, why would you build a non-carbon intensive industrial sector? It's not just to say, well, you know, we've been very good to the planet. It's to also say that as consumers, as regulators, as global authorities begin to care about the carbon intensity of production, then the low carbon intensity of Africa's energy systems, if we can scale them up with as little carbon as possible, then that becomes a competitive hook. You're able to say, we are a better manufacturing or processing destination than Europe, the Americas, or Asia, because we deploy many fewer units of carbon per unit of production than anyone else. Because we built our systems more recently, so they already started with a low carbon intensity. And because of geography and geology and physics, we happen to have structural advantages around deploying those things that no one else can match. So it's a competitiveness argument. So on the one hand, there's a new set of activities around carbon capture and removal that can employ literally millions of people across Africa, for which, you know, through the work we're doing with CAPE, we began to really size that opportunity. But there's also a very clear competitiveness argument that says that if you make the right investments in your energy system and your production system, then you're able to actually attract manufacturing activity, attract data processing activity by saying, we can offer for you the lowest carbon intensity of any place in the world to build a sophisticated economy.
If you had one message for African leaders going to COP in November, and I include sort of the African Union delegation and in that, who by all accounts are going to be campaigning quite hard for a more pro-gas position than the one you've articulated. If you had a chance to corner them in a lift for 20 minutes, what would you say?
I would say to them, make sure you have actually run the detail, you know, let the numbers speak for themselves. Step back from dogma of any kind and actually interrogate the case for different solutions for your respective countries, and make sure that you're factoring into your thinking the effects of time. So if we had a whole gas infrastructure already built in Africa or about to be built in Africa, I would say, yes, by all means, we have the right for to be the last ones to turn it off. We also have the right to be the last ones to build, but that's not really a right worth having. You know, the fact that I have the right to be the last one to walk into a condemned building doesn't mean I should walk into it. Everyone else walked in and walked out, and are now walking out. Insisting on walking in myself is not a rigorous defense of my interests. It is short-sighted. And we need to understand what building we're walking into and why. And maybe the last thing I'll emphasize again, this is not to say that we write off our endowment of natural resources. To the extent that we can package it for export, let us do that and derive the financial benefit that we can then invest in building modern energy systems for ourselves, but only use it for our own energy systems where it makes clear and long-term economic sense. Nowhere else. I do think we also need to pay attention to how other parts of the world are thinking about the future of their energy systems. Amidst all of the brouhaha about Europe ordering large loads of coal and gas and so on from around the world to power itself through the current energy crisis, what is missed is the massive commitments being made to fuels of the future, such as hydrogen. Now, it's not necessarily missed. I think we are all kind of aware of it. But we need to also be conscious of that as those plans begin to build momentum and as solutions like green and blue hydrogen become more viable, the global markets for this product will begin to decline. The amount of scientific innovation or technological innovation around how you use the product will also begin to ramp down as we pivot to new energy systems. Now, that's not a five-year problem, but frankly, nothing that isn't built now is going to be, you know, really relevant 5 years from now anyway, right? So by the time that anything we could build as of today would become relevant, we're sitting in a world where we are a lot closer to a more hydrogen-based economy than we are today. And we need to be thinking about how are we preparing for that day, not today. Let's run to where the ball is going to be, not where the ball is today.
James, thank you so much for what was an absolutely fascinating conversation and one which I'm sure will provoke lots of heated discussion. It really has been great to talk to you. And thank you to our listeners. Please do check out the other podcasts on the Africa Climate Change Conversation platform hosted on the British International Investment website, www.bii.co.uk.